Let's go ahead and go into our message today. So we are in a series titled Jesus Revealed. And in this series, we're continuing through the second chapter of John, the Gospel of John, where we're looking at different aspects of Jesus, who is being revealed to the disciples as we read, but also is being revealed to us as well. And last week, we got a glimpse of the power of Jesus by turning water into wine. Today, we're going to be seeing the passion of Jesus. And this morning, or this got me thinking, what are we passionate about? What are we passionate about? A few years ago, there's a woman who got out of her car at Chick-fil-A and accidentally dropped her phone, her iPhone, down a storm drain. But as you may know, Chick-fil-A is all about good customer service. We might even say they are passionate about customer service. And so when Seth, a Chick-fil-A employee, found out about the lost iPhone, he wanted to help. So he, first of all, called the city workers, but they weren't too much help. And so he then managed to remove the manhole cover, slicing his finger in the process, but he removed the manhole cover and tried to use a stick to get the iPhone out. But the stick fell into the hole. And so finally, he profoundly says, and I like this line here, "It's a manhole for a reason, so I'm going down." I like that. He then goes down into the hole and retrieves the iPhone. And this worker was so passionate about customer service that he was willing to go down a manhole to help someone out. And when I read that story a number of years ago, I remember thinking, what would I go down a manhole for? Am I passionate enough about my, I don't have an iPhone, I have an Android. Am I passionate enough about my Android, which, by the way, has insurance, so if I lose it, I can just get a new one, I believe, I hope. But would I go down a manhole to retrieve it? But this got me thinking, what would you all be so passionate about that you all would go down a manhole to retrieve? So we did this about 5 years ago, and I'm going to invite one couple up here to share their thoughts as well. So how long have you two been married?
20 years.
Oh, no, okay. 19. We're coming up on 20.
So 20 years. Okay. So you all are probably very similar to each other now in a lot of your likes and dislikes. We'll see. So you have a yes and a no here. Each of you are going to get it. And you're going to share just your own opinion. So you don't have to guess what your spouse is going to say. Okay. But you're just going to share whether you would go down a manhole for these particular items. And so we'll just go. Already know. Yeah. All right. Well, let's start with the first one here. Would you go down a manhole for your child? See? Yes. There you go. All right. So yes. So both have that. Which one? Your favorite one. So which one is that? All right. Would you go down a manhole for your engagement ring? Yes.
I would send him, though.
Send Eric down. All right, here's the next one here. Would you go down for your purse or for your wife's purse? No. I'm starting to see a little difference here now. All right. You would just send one of your sons down, right?
Yeah. I mean, this is why I have all these books.
All right, next one. Next one is, would you send, or not send, see, now you got me confused. What about for your dog? You don't have a dog, right?
Oh. No. Not a chance.
If you had a dog, listen, that's dangerous to say at this church.
Sorry, Judy. No. No.
All right, so the answer is no. It got the temperature seemed to change in the church all in one sentence. All right, would you go down for a $100 gift card to TJ Maxx?
Yeah, I would do that.
So you are almost on the same page here. All right, we have just a couple more. Would you go down for Dunkin' Donuts coffee and donuts? No. All right, you're agreed on that. What about for your favorite hat? Okay, you lost your favorite hat then.
My favorite hat was eaten by a dog.
It was eaten by the dog that's down in the manhole there. Yeah.
It's a true story.
All right, here's the last one here. No pressure now. Would you go down for a stray kitten?
No.
Oh. Oh. All right. I'm sorry that I've just sort of tainted your reputation here.
Did we pass?
There was no pass. It was just sort of you win for coming up. So let's give them a hand as they head on down here. By the way, those cold-hearted people are involved. Megan leads one of our Bible studies, the women's Bible study, on Thursdays. And then Eric leads our youth group. So parents, sorry. Would we all agree that all of us are passionate about something or even a lot of things? Now, whether it be ideas like popularity or work ethic or religious beliefs or political beliefs, all of us are passionate about certain ideas. All of us are also passionate about things, certain things. Maybe it's more physical, like a spouse. We're passionate about our spouse, our children. Maybe it's a sports team that we're cheering or crying about in this particular football season. Maybe it's a car that you love or some other gadget or item. But today we're going to see two things that Jesus is passionate about. And you may be wondering, if you're new here, what's the big deal with learning about what Jesus is passionate about? And the reason is that it should come as no surprise to you that as Christians, we should be passionate about the same things that Jesus is passionate about. As Christians, our lives come out of Christ. We talked about that a few weeks ago. He is the vine, and we are the branches. We're not our own. We're growing out of Jesus. And so we bear fruit that comes out of a relationship with him. And so let's go ahead and let's take a look at our passage, and we're going to see some things that Jesus is passionate about, and we'll talk about what we can learn from that. So again, John chapter 2, starting in verse 13. The Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem in the temple and found those who were selling oxen and sheep and pigeons and the money changers, and they were and the money changers were just sitting there. Jesus and his disciples decide to head to the temple. It's Passover, as the passage says. Passover was a very important holiday for the Jews. And it goes back to the time when the angel of death passed over the Jews in Egypt, killing the firstborn of the Egyptians. That night, the Jews were set free. After 400 years of slavery in Egypt, they were set free and were able to go. And so they commemorated what God did that night by rescuing them. And so Passover was a very, very important holiday for the Jews. It was so important that every adult male within a 15-mile radius of Jerusalem was required to attend. So many, many Jews that lived further would also make a pilgrimage in that day, that particular holiday, to Jerusalem at that time, including even foreigners coming in that followed God. Now, I was trying to think of a modern-day illustration, and none of these examples are going to be perfect, but I thought of, I grew up in Maryland, so in Washington, D.C. on the 4th of July, everyone converges downtown, it seemed like, to celebrate and to watch the fireworks go off. Or in New York City, on New Year's Eve, everyone comes down, and there's these masses and masses of people gathering together for this holiday as people get together and celebrate. It was also, Passover was a profitable time by the time of Jesus. So each person that came was required to pay a temple tax before they could sacrifice. But in addition to that, people that came from far away may have different currency. And so they had to exchange their currency into the correct currency in order to pay the tax. And if you came from far away and if you didn't have an animal, they had that for you as well for the sacrifice. So you could purchase an animal right there at the temple. And each transaction, there was likely a profit being made by the sellers. And so Jesus steps into the scene and does not like what he's seeing there. Let's look at verse 15. And making a whip of cords, he drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and oxen. And he poured out the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. And he told those who sold the pigeons, take these things away. And do not make my father's house a house of trade. So Jesus drives out the people that are making a profit off of the worship of God. And he makes this whip and begins chasing people out. I would have loved to have seen that if there was a surveillance camera of that ever comes out. He overturns tables and dumps money on the ground. Now, I do want to point out, though, that nowhere in this passage or in any of the other Gospels is there an indication that he hurts anyone. So no one's hurt, animal, there you go, or human. No one's hurt there, at least is indicated. But Jesus is clearly on a mission there because he is doing it in a way that scares people enough to be driven out of the temple. And I was thinking about this week. Why in the world is he doing this in terms, when we think of his temperament? Because let's think about this. This is the same person who would later be mocked and whipped and tortured, and what would he do? Nothing. Nothing. He would not retaliate in any way. And someone may say, well, he was bound up. But this is God we're talking about, who could have sent angels to just wipe out everyone, who was making names and calling him names and whipping him and putting thorns on his head and nailing him to the cross, but he did nothing. So why is he acting the way he's acting in the temple now in John 2? And the answer is given in this next verse. His disciples remembered later on that it was written, zeal for your house will consume me. So it was his zeal, his passion, not just for anything in particular, but it was his zeal for, quote, your house. Your house being referring to God's temple there. And as I already said, the temple was a place where people gathered together to worship God. And it was a place where God figuratively dwelled among his people there in the Holy of Holies. So Jesus did not like that they were turning God's temple, the place where God dwelled and where people worshiped him, he didn't like that they were turning it into a marketplace. But it goes deeper than just it being a building. Because Jesus' passion was not ultimately about a physical structure. It was about what was represented behind the idea of the structure and what the money changers and religious leaders were doing to it. And so for the rest of the time, I'm going to focus on two areas that Jesus was passionate about that are revealed as he drives out the money changers. And if you have your teaching sheets that are inside the bulletin, here is the first point. And that is a passion for true worship. For true worship. So again, the temple was a place for worship. And the religious leaders of that time had turned worship into an opportunity just to make money. They were corrupting it. They had corrupted worship. So Jesus drives them out because he didn't want impure worship. Now, I want to be clear here. Jesus wasn't driving them out just because they were selling something per se. He wasn't driving them out just because they had a storefront going on. He was driving out because of what it was doing and how it was corrupting the worship there. So some people say, we're not going to have any distraction anywhere in the church. We're not going to sell books. We're not going to give away coffee cups. You know, we're not going to have donuts those things are not here like at Iron Pond. They're not corrupting worship here. And so the issue is not just what was going on. It's what was behind it. That it was corrupting the worship. But here's the thing. When Jesus died on the cross, in Matthew we see that the curtain, when he died, the curtain tore into two. The curtain separating God and the Holy Holies and the rest of the temple there. The curtain tore into two. And that symbolically showed a new reality for every person. That we no longer need to go to a temple to be near God, because now God had come out and God was now dwelling in the life of every believer that follows Jesus Christ. So what does that mean? Now we, every person who follows Jesus Christ, now we are his temple. In 1 Corinthians 6:19, Paul makes this very clear. He says, "Or do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit within you, whom you have received," or whom you have from God. So since we are the temple, we don't need to gather in a temple to worship him. We can worship him wherever we go. Now, some of you may ask, well, why do we gather in church on Sunday morning? And this is a building that happens to hold the church. And so we gather together as the church, choosing to worship in this building. So even though this structure is called a church, in reality, there's nothing sacred about the building itself. It's that we are gathering here to study his word and to sing songs, worshiping him and giving and offering. We're worshiping him in that way. But, listen, and this is important. Since we are his temple, that means that true worship now comes from us. Not just from a building, but true worship now comes in us and out of us. Paul says this in Romans 12:1. I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. So Paul tells us to give not just our Sunday mornings, not just our voices, not just one portion of our life. He tells us to give our entire life as a sacrifice to God, and to do this in a way that is holy and acceptable. And listen, that right there is true worship. So singing is one way that we worship God. But God doesn't want just our voices. He wants our entire life. So listen, if you sing passionately on Sunday morning, and by the way, I hope you do. And as a side, I met with someone who visited the church a few weeks ago, a ministry leader. And he said, he's gone to a number of churches. He said, your church wasn't the rockiest church, but man, you all really sang. And that warmed my heart, let me tell you. Yeah, we're not the rockiest church. But the point is not whether we're rocky enough or not. Are we worshiping God with the music that we're singing? And are we singing out? So yes, I hope that you sing and sing loudly. In just a little bit, we'll be doing a closing song. And man, I hope you sing so loud that poor Richard up here can't even hear his own voice. That'd be a good problem to have. But listen, if you're not living out in a way that glorifies him the rest of the week, then you're not worshiping him like you should. If you go to church each week, by the way, I hope you do, but don't give him your heart the other 6 days, then you're not worshiping him like you should. If you follow him some of the time and then follow after sinful passions other times, you're not worshiping him like you should. So you're called to worship him with your entire life. Jesus didn't take worship lightly, and therefore, neither should we. I read about a man named Daniel Lehner and his wife Remy, and they were married on December 12th, 1993, and apparently they were big on celebrating anniversaries. And so as they got close to their first anniversary, they began planning out their second anniversary, and it was a big one. And so for their second anniversary, they made plans to go see their favorite Broadway show, The Phantom of the Opera, in the early 90s. That was a big one. And since it was their anniversary, they went big. And when I say big, I mean big, big. So more than a year in advance, they bought tickets for every seat in the house at New York's Majestic Theater, all 1,609 of the seats, for them, for a year out, for their anniversary day to celebrate. Now, would we all agree that they probably went a little overboard? They probably were a little extravagant. I mean, come on, at least invite some of your friends here. But if we think about it, going overboard and being extravagant is a mark of being in love, isn't it? That shows the love. In fact, I would say it's even a mark of passionate love. That passionate love shows extravagance, and it shows going overboard. And church, Jesus showed you and me passionate love by going to the cross to die for us. And while we can't repay him and are not even asked to repay him, we are asked to love him. And I want to encourage each of you to grow that love, and to grow that love even more, so that, hey, there's a little bit of extravagance inside of you in loving him. And so that as you grow in your love for him, that every part of your life will grow in love and to worship him. And that there won't be these little pockets, these little corners of your life that you've hidden away that you want to keep for yourself, but give them all to him and worship to him. So that's the first thing that we see in this passage, a passion for true worship. So let's move on now to the second part here, the second passion that's revealed in Jesus driving out the money changers, and that is a passion for all people. When I was on vacation last year, my wife and I went to church down in Virginia, and we listened to a sermon by the pastor, David Platt. And he preached on Mark 11, which was the clearing of the temple in Mark 11. And it really made an impression on me. So when I got to this passage, I decided that for this particular section, I want to use some of the things that he said as well. So he said them better, but I'm gonna use some of the things that he said in this section here. Mark 11 is also the story, as I said, of Jesus clearing the temple. And there's some debate about whether John 2 and Mark 11 and the other Gospels, whether they're talking about the same event or about two separate clearings of the temple. And I would say, after looking into it this week, most people think that there's two separate clearings, one at the beginning of Jesus' ministry and one at the end of his ministry, which would be in Mark 11. But there's also some that think that it's the same event. But regardless, whether it's the same or different, a lot of the same things happen. And Jesus walks into the temple in Mark 11 at Passover, and he begins driving out the money changers. But the difference here is in what is quoted by Jesus and what Jesus is quoted as saying. So Jesus says, and this is in Mark 11, 17, and he was teaching them and saying to them, so this is after the clearing, "Is it not written, 'My house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations,' but you have made it a den of robbers"? So Jesus gives some insight as to why he's so upset and why he's worked up about driving people out of the temple. And it's similar to John 2, but in Mark 11 now, he's quoting, Jesus is quoting Isaiah 56, 7. And so let's go to Isaiah 56, because this sheds some light on this passage, on what Jesus is saying. In Isaiah 56, this is verse 6 and 7. Says, "And the foreigners," so let me point this out here, "and the foreigners who joined themselves to the Lord, to minister to him, to love the name of the Lord, and to be his servants, everyone who keeps the Sabbath and does not profane it and holds fast my covenant." So before we go to the next verse, who is he talking about here? Not the Jews, but the foreigners. "These I will bring to my holy mountain, and I will make them joyful in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and their sacrifices will be accepted on my altar, for my house shall be called a house of prayer for all peoples." So Jesus here is quoting Isaiah in this passage to show that God's temple was not just for the Jews, but that God's temple was for the non-Jews as well. So let's think about what's going on here with the money changers and what they were doing in the temple. And so let me bring up a picture of the temple. And what we see here, I know it's a little difficult to see, but at the very top is number one. And that number one there is the Holy of Holies. And God was living in that spot, figuratively speaking. That's where he dwelled among his people. And so the high priests were the only ones that were allowed to go into the Holy of Holies. And it was only on certain periods, at certain periods of time, and after they had cleansed themselves and gone through multiple days of rituals and cleansings to prepare themselves. In fact, it was such a holy place that if they came in there in an unholy way, guess what happened to them? They were gone. And so they had to go in there with a bell tied to them and a rope attached to their leg, so that if people after a period of time didn't hear any more ringing, they're like, "Oh, I guess High Priest Joe wasn't so holy after all." And so they had to start pulling them out. That's the holiness of the Holy of Holies there. But as you work your way out of the temple, then we get to the court of the priests that you see in the middle there, number 5 and 7. And this is where the priests prepared and made the sacrifices. And then around that was the court of Israel at number 6. And here the Jewish men would come to worship God. But then outside of that was the court of women at number 9. And the court of women was where, guess what? The Jewish women would come to worship God. And then finally, outside of that was the court of the Gentiles, the court of Gentiles at number 12. And this is where people from all nations would come to sacrifice and to worship God and really to be in God's presence as he was figuratively there. And so I'm going to give you one guess about where you think the people and the religious leaders set up the tables and sold the animals. It was not the court of Israel. It was not the court of women. They were selling all their things in the court of the Gentiles. And so when Jesus comes in and he declares, "My house will be a house of prayer for all peoples," that was because the Jews had arranged the temple to be comfortable for them while neglecting the foreigners. Jesus' passion for the non-Jews comes out clearly here. He drives out the money changers and the other people because they were not just corrupting worship, but they were also preventing all peoples from worshiping God. So let me ask you, how might we be doing the same? Do we as Christians ever let our comfort get in the way of reaching all people? Do we ever let what is good for us prevent us from letting others see and glorify God? We're like, oh, no, I'm going to do this because I like it, because it's good for me. Listen, now that we are God's temple, things have changed a little bit, just like in the first point. And so instead of foreigners coming to the temple, God instructs his people, his temple, to go to the foreigners. And what is keeping us from telling or from going? I would say usually it's our comfort. It's our convenience. And so it's no stretch to say that far too often we individually and as a church are like the people selling in the temple. So church, may that not be said of us. May we not let our comfort stop us from making sure all peoples hear about Jesus. I read about Eva Hart. And she was on this ship that hit an iceberg on April 15th, 1912, Titanic. And she survived. And so years later, she wrote an account of it. And the iceberg, after the Titanic hit it, it was about 2 hours and 40 minutes before the ship went down and everybody was in the water in some form or fashion. And Eva writes, "I saw all the horror of its sinking, and I heard even more dreadful the cries of drowning people." So the horrible thing is that more people could have been saved. Most people that were on the Titanic did not end up in a lifeboat. So what happened when the ship went down? They ended up in the water. And the water was about 28 degrees Fahrenheit. And so the people in the water only had a very short period of time. In fact, if you've seen the movie, you saw what happened to Jack, right? They only had a short period of time before drowning, before basically freezing to death and going under. And so there were 20 lifeboats and rafts that were launched, and most of them were not completely full. But 19 of those lifeboats stayed back, away from the crowds of people, and simply listened to them struggling in the icy seas. Why didn't they go back? Because they feared that they were going to be overwhelmed with people in the water, and they would capsize the lifeboats. And church, Jesus has shown us that people matter to him. when he saw foreigners being ignored and being pushed aside, he passionately stood up for them. And so I want to close with a question here. Will we allow fear or discomfort to get in the way of reaching people who don't know Jesus? So I want to encourage you, let's follow Jesus' lead and let's passionately seek after those who don't know Jesus. Man, let's not be like those in the lifeboats where we're safe, where we're relatively speaking comfortable, and we're just listening to those as they are slowly headed towards hell. Let's not be like those. Let's put aside our comfort. Let's put aside our fear. Let's be willing to go and to reach those that don't know Jesus, both in our community and even more overseas, where many people overseas have never even had the opportunity to hear about the message of Jesus. So we're going to go ahead and go into a time of prayer, and then we're going to sing a closing song. And I want to encourage you that if any part of this message has maybe struck with you or just given you a little pain, that let's think about that and pray about that and just spend a moment with God, asking him that, hey, God, lead me to be less comfortable. Lead me to worship you in a true way. So let's go ahead and spend a moment in prayer.